Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuckinistas, what the fuck Tuckians, what the fuck Knicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Welcome to the show. Today on the show, Jay Mascis drops by. Literally, he just wanted to come by. But I mean, to me, that is an honor, and it makes me feel good. He didn't have anything to really promote. He just wanted to chat, play a couple songs, so look forward to that coming up. Me and Jay Mascis, Dinosaur Jr. If you don't, if you're like, who the fuck is Jay Mascis? Oh, also on the show, Danny Fields. I tried to wrangle about 50 years of rock history into a conversation with Danny, who's not always following a straight line, but he's like punk rock zealot, man. He was there at the juncture of some of the most important turning points of modern rock fucking music, Danny Fields. And I was happy he was out here. I wrote his mind. I held on. And we got somewhere. Got a lot of places. Got an interesting email today. Eureka, I'm manic. Hi, Mark. 40-something Long Island artist type living in SoCal. I enjoy your podcast for your relatable guests and the memories of the tri-state area. WTF is like an East Coast slice of pizza. Thank you. Nice thin crust. I recently listened to the AJ Mendez Brooks interview and had a eureka moment. Holy shit, I'm bipolar. Everything completely made sense to me. Like the scene when Ed Norton found out he was also Brad Pitt in Fight Club. Recollections of manic episodes raced through my mind. Like this one time I was rifling through my trunk for an ice scraper during a New York blizzard, and 4 days later my car is overheating in California. No job, no plan, and no resolve for the mania. I used to refer to these moments as firecrackers. They are fun to play with, slightly dangerous, bright, loud, then go away. Afterward, the smoke, it's a mess, it smells, and always costs money. I'm going to take a pause and look at myself. I'll let you know how things go. Keep it up. You're changing lives. Signed, Tyler Durden. Anyway, let me tell you this story. Look, I don't see myself as a celebrity. You know, I'm a mid-level guy who works at home. Sometimes does some on-camera stuff, also gets out on stage a lot. But, you know, I'm just a working stiff in the big business of show, you dig? Whatever experience I've had here in the garage with very famous, brilliant, not so brilliant and famous people that have come through here, once they sit down after about 10 minutes, I can kind of, you know, manage myself, you know, manage whatever fanness I might have, fandom, or just, you know, people become people very quickly, you know, and it just, and I know that, but here's what happened. It was pretty exciting. I guess, I don't know if it was exciting, it was weird, because I don't live the life. I'm not living the life. I don't know if you know that, but I'm not living the life, okay? Like, here's what I assume. I assume people who are living the life don't ever have to unplug things to plug other things in. And that, it's a weird thought I always have when I'm trying to plug in my burr grinder and also my blender. Can't do it. Got to unplug one to plug in the other. And I always think at that moment, you know, people who are living the life, they got plenty of plugs and everything's in its own place and it all works together. And it's just a beautiful, clean and easy move through the world for the people that are living the life. Plenty of plugs. Anyway, I go to the U2 concert. Now, I don't go to many concerts, you know that, but I got offered some tickets to go see U2 here at the Rose Bowl. Dan, Cook over at Gimme Gimme Records was actually the best guy to go with. Dan and I went, and at the last minute, the publicist sent me a parking pass. So it was like, all right, now I'm living the life. We are just cruising down, you know, through cop checkpoints directly into the parking lot. No other cars. This special lane for people living the life, and we're in it. Dan and I are living the life, parking at the Rose Bowl to see you two. So we go in, we get our seats. They're nice seats. They're not on the field, which is all standing. They're seated, and they're like stage right, and we can see the big screens. We can see everything. It's nice out. It's beautiful, you know? Got a lemonade, sitting around, talking about music, and we're waiting. And then the Luminaires come on. It's okay. You know, I like them. It's a country band. Seems like it to me. I don't know what people are calling them, but it seemed like pretty solid kind of folk country stuff. Enjoyed it. About midway through the Luminaires, I get a text from the publicity people. They're like, hey, we're going to come down and give you a pass to the Desert Lounge. I'm like, all right, I don't know what that is. So Steve from the publicity place, he comes over, gives me a Desert Lounge pass. And you know, we were pretty comfortable there, having a lemonade, talking music, and the beautiful night, waiting for you two, listening to the Luminaires. But, you know, we go with Steve to the Desert Lounge. Now, the Desert Lounge is just a big tent with a bunch of people in it. And I don't know what we're doing there. It's like, you know, it's not like the special room. It's just a room with people who are affiliated or paid some money or family, friends, whatever, hanging out in a big bar setting in a tent that's air conditioned, which was nice. Someone told me they just saw, you know, Scott Aukerman and Adam Scott. And I'm like, I know those guys. Where are they? I don't know where they are. They're not here anymore. I said, well, let's just go out back out, man. I was in the zone. I was sitting in an arena. I was waiting for the band. I was like in the zone. I liked it outside. I don't know who these people are. It's like a fucking nightclub. I go tell Steve, like, thanks for the Desert Lounge pass, and we're gonna go back out to the arena. And he's like, well, don't you want to meet you too? And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah. I mean, they're gonna do a little meet and greet, I think, in about 15 minutes. I mean, Bono's not, because he's, you know, taking care of his voice, but I think the other guys are. I'm like, I don't know what for? Am I can't interview him here? I don't know. And he looked at me weird, and I'm like, oh, what am I? I'm an idiot. Yeah, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, I can do that. I don't have to go sit out there in the arena. And then we walk through this little tunnel area, backstagey looking, you know, locker room kind of, into a room that's hot. All I know is what we were just in an air conditioned room, and now we're walked into a room full of people, and it's hot as fuck, like a sauna hot. And I'm like, what is this? And all of a sudden, my eyes just start looking around, and I do a little like 180 look, and I'm like, that's Sean Penn on the couch. Sean Penn on the couch. Sean Penn's just sitting there talking to people. Now, look, I don't care how many people I've had in here or what you think of anybody. You know, when I see movie stars, I act like a person who's seeing a movie star. And I'm like, well, I don't tell my face to do that because I'm a professional. But inside, I'm like, it's fucking Sean Penn. Look at him. Look at him. Look at his face. It's Sean Penn's face. He's like a little Sean Penn's old face with his mustache. And then I start scanning around. I'm like, what the fuck is happening in here? There's Julia Roberts. What is going on in here? And then I see Aukerman and Adam Scott. And I'm like, okay, I know those guys. So I go over there. I'm like, what's up? Hey, we're chit-chatting around. Then I start looking around. I'm like, holy fuck, is it Josh Brolin? Is that Josh Brolin? And Jesus Christ, what is this place? So then I'm like, holy shit, there's Sacha Baron Cohen. So I know him because he was on the show. So I start talking to Sacha Baron Cohen. Then Jimmy Kimmel comes over. We're talking about his kid who's doing all right. And then Patricia Arquette, who's been on the show, she says hi, and it's like, oh my God, this is it. This is a big-time celebrity holding pen. And I'm just always surprised. Like, I could not stop looking at the side of Josh Brolin's head because I think he's a great actor. And in my brain is sort of like, he's just a dude. I'm like, yeah, but God damn it, he was good. No Country for Old Men. Come on. Hail Caesar, please. Whatever. I have a natural fan reaction to movie stars and actors that I like, and I'm fighting it. I'm fighting it. I'm doing okay with the fight. I'm talking. It was nice to talk to people that I knew in here who know me, and that was fun to be. But I'm not that level. I'm not living the life. I'm really on some level just a guy who works out of his house. And I was excited. And Dan had never been. He was like, you know, he was hiding his shit better than me, just acting normal around these highly celebritized people. But at some point, me and Dan pull away. And it happened. It just happened. You know, I'm scanning the room, not really scanning it because I've already taken it in. And then the Edge comes out, and then I'm like, there's the Edge. Maybe I should go say hi. Oh, he's talking to Matt Damon. I don't know Matt Damon. I'm not just going to walk up and go, hey, man, what's going on? Marc Maron, excuse me, Matt. I don't know him. I know he's just a person. They're all just people, but I don't know him. So I didn't meet the edge. But anyway, so Dan and I are getting, I'm like, I can't take anymore. I met Hal Wilner. That was actually very exciting, the music producer. But like right before we were about to leave the room because it was too hot, and I just wanted to go sit out in the arena and wait for the fucking band. It was where it's nice and comfortable. Have a lemonade. And like I'm just about, we're about to walk out, and I look towards the door, and there's a man surrounded by people, few people, and that's when I just broke, and I just looked at Dan. I pointed across the room, and I said, "Quincy Jones!" About that loud, Quincy Jones. No one turned or looked or heard me, but that was it. That's what tipped it, Quincy Jones. So then we left the celebrity holding pen. And we went back to the seats, and sure enough, like about 15 minutes after we went back to the seats, they led every occupant of the celebrity holding pen into the stands where they were magically just people at a show. And Quincy Jones sat just down to the right where we were sitting, and Bono gave him a shout out during the show, which I thought was beautiful. And of course, it was so funny because these were good seats, obviously, but right behind us, there was this couple that were just, I think they were fucking tripping, man. I mean, full on tripping balls. And they were right behind me, and they, you know, they're playing the whole Joshua Tree, and the band sounds fucking great, and they're focused. And I'd forgotten what a tremendous fucking record that is, what a huge fucking record that is, just shaking me at the foundation of my soul. Beautiful. But there was this couple behind us. They were dancing so much that the people around them had to move aside, and the girl was just screaming out of context. So it's like, yeah, but really obnoxious, horrible scream. I don't know why. And the guy was singing along with Bono and then doing call and response with him, and nobody else was. But they, you know, they were just like sweaty and tripping balls and annoying. But I had that moment where I'm like, at first it was like, you know, why we got, what, just my luck. I got to be in front of these two people. But then it was sort of like, you know, that's what music does, man. That's what music does. That guy's singing along with Bono in the same space, and it's probably the greatest day, one of the best days he's having. She's going crazy. I turned around once or twice. She was crying. And I'm like, they're not annoying. They're doing what they should be doing. They're ecstatic. They're ecstatic at a rock and roll show. What more can you ask for? So, look, Jay Maskus just wanted to come by. So I said, sure, Jay, come by. And he came by. And he left his capo. He left his capo here. He took my tuner and left his capo. So I emailed him and I said, Jay, I think we swapped my tuner for your capo. And then Jay wrote back, okay, you cool with it? Or should I mail it back? Good seeing you. And I said, cool with me. If it's cool with you, just wanted to make sure you knew before you had to play a gig. I needed a capo. And then he said, cool, find your key. Isn't that the whole thing? Find your key. This is me and Jay Maskus. He has the last Dinosaur Jr. album was a while ago. You can get any Dinosaur Jr. album. Give a Glimpse of What You're Not was released last year, but he just wanted to hang out. So this.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Me and Jay. Jay Maskus back in the garage, round two.
All right. I'm going to get pumped up right now.
Yeah, use that little squeeze. That's a hard one, too. Yeah. I always wonder what it's interesting when people fidget with you. I don't know what they're going to pick up. So I haven't seen you in a few years. We had a nice chat the last time. What are you doing out here?
Not much. My kid was going to Disney World with my two sisters and my brother, and me and my wife didn't want to go, so we decided to come to California, and it's our first trip together away from the kid.
Oh, really? Yeah. How old's the kid now?
9.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, so are you staying at a swanky hotel?
Not swanky. Yeah. We had a bit of a Airbnb disaster, you know.
Oh, yeah.
We were supposed to go to this place in Malibu, and you know, my wife's really into Columbo, so, you know, there's these winding hills.
Yeah.
And you know, it does look like Columbo up there, but when we got to the house...
The TV show Columbo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we got to the house, we got really scared, and there's really loud wind chimes, and it was just creepy, and the shower looked like some weird hobbit cave, and I was just like, I gotta get out of here.
Oh, really? So it was a vibe. It wasn't there wasn't people living there.
No.
You just got, creeped out.
Yeah, totally.
Really? Well, I mean, that sounds like just like one of those weirdo Malibu houses.
Yeah, but...
And it had something else going on?
I didn't want to be there when night fell. You know what I mean? I was just like, I couldn't picture that.
So did you end up coming back into town? Or did you get holed up out in Malibu?
No, yeah, we bailed back to Santa Monica.
Well, that's fun. How long are you in town for?
It's a Monday.
Who are you hanging out with? What'd you do today?
Just rode a bike on the beach and came over here.
All right, so now we're going to talk about this record because I pulled it out just because it was something that I bought. Well, this is the story with this. Her name is, how do you pronounce it?
Sybil Baer.
Sybil Baer?
Baer.
Baer? Because you're German.
Yeah.
Your wife's German.
Yeah.
But like I had this. It was sent to me probably by the label.
Yeah.
And I was going through records. And I put it into a box that I was going to trade out, but I knew I thought I'd listen to it, and I thought it was something, and I didn't know anything about it, and I brought it over to Dan, you know, the guy who likes a certain type of music. Goes, oh, you don't want to get rid of this one. I'm like, really? Yeah. He's like, yeah, no, that's a great record, and I think that's the only way it exists. This record, it's not a reissue.
No,
but you had something to do with this because I just pulled this out. But what happened with this record?
Well, yeah, since my wife's Germans, we know a lot of other Germans wandering around in the Northeast, and one of them brought us to this guy, Robbie Byers' house,
yeah,
you know, like an hour away, and said, oh, he's my friend, blah, blah, blah.
What's he do, that guy?
He's a musician as well, and we go there, and he's playing this music, and it's like, sounds very, like, contemporary, like, this sounds like this could be an indie rock hit,
you know,
it's very... Cat Power, like,
right.
I was like, what is this? This is like, this is totally what's happening, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this is my mom. I compiled some of her songs for her birthday. I made it into I went through her tapes and made this, you know, compilation. I was like, you could definitely get this put out. And he's like, oh, really? You want to, yeah, just give me the tape. I'll give it to some people. And then I gave it to some people, and, this guy in Elf Power, I knew he'd be really into it. He was over at my house, and I played him, and his eyes lit up. You know, I knew he got all psyched. And
did it find success?
Well, with record nerds, yes. You know.
Right, right, yeah. It's a really beautiful record.
Yeah, it's awesome.
You know what I listened to for the first time, I think? Adele.
Yeah, I got into Adele through The Voice. Like,
right.
I started watching The Voice with my kid, and...
Yeah.
This guy, Billy Gilman, did an Adele song, and I was like, Billy Gilman, I was obsessed with him, like, in the early 90s, because he was this child country star. He was, like, 12, and he had these hits, and we went to the beach once with this drag queen who's like, you gotta listen to Billy Gilman. Like, all the drag queens were all over this kid. They could smell the tragedy on him already, and I was like, we'd listen to it, and the song was amazing, and I couldn't believe suddenly he's grown up and on The Voice, and
he's a judge.
No, he was a contestant.
Oh, he was a contestant.
And it turned out he was gay. Like, they could sniff it out then.
They knew.
Yeah. And
he did an Adele song?
He did an Adele song. I got into Adele through that.
I had this moment where I'm like, I don't know if I've ever heard an Adele song.
Yeah.
And like these records and you know, pop music is pop music, but people love her.
Yeah.
And it's not like she's some fluke. So I listened, and I'm like, holy shit, it's like some of the stuff I heard was kind of like, you know, like old soul kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I like her.
Yeah, she has such a cool personality like that.
Yeah.
And she's in the car singing with James Corden.
I got to watch that.
Pretty amazing. Yeah.
You're the second person that told me to watch that.
Yeah.
What about Lorde? Let's talk pop stars.
I don't know much about
her. Know much about her? You ever seen her? She dances wild.
No, she's
compelling.
She played with Nirvana, I remember, at the... Rock and Roll Hall.
That's where I first saw her. She must have been like 15, 16, maybe 17 years old, and that kind of blew me away. Very intense.
Yeah, then I played an after party with Nirvana that same night, and everyone else came, but she didn't show up to sing.
Oh, really? Maybe it was too late. She was like in high school. You know what I've been listening to is that The Ravi Shankar records.
Yeah, right. Yes.
I mean, he's got a vibe, right?
Yeah.
They're relaxing, aren't they?
Yeah, I love all that. Any raga thing I'm a sucker for. You know?
Do you ever think about doing like a Jamascus raga?
Yeah, I do like sometimes some fake kind of stuff like that in yoga places with some, you know, guys I know who play in yoga places and do kirtans.
So wait, now let me just understand this. You're doing some yoga place gigs?
Sometimes. Well, I'll do my my impression of Ravi Shankar, which sounds more like Mick Taylor.
Wait, just let's flesh this out a little bit. So
yeah.
Where's the yoga tour take you? Like where you,
Brooklyn, usually.
So you just show up, like they do live music at yoga places?
Yeah.
Like in, now, are you billed? Like are you Jamascus Yoga?
Well, I have a gig coming up. Yeah, it's me and this guy David Das and Tony, who I play with. We usually play together.
And people are doing yoga. So you're working?
No, it's just at a yoga place. They're just singing.
Oh, that's different.
Singing along.
I pictured that, like, today's class is going to be interesting. I'm going to talk you through the poses, and Jamascus is going to be playing some music for you.
I would do that, yeah.
Well, is it challenging to do something meditative?
No, I like it.
What, do you do acoustic?
No.
No.
I like to play electric. Or I can play my electric sitar and get...
You have one of those?
Yeah, the fake, you know, like 60s.
Yeah. Now, is it? Does it look like a guitar?
Well, they try to make it look like a sitar, but it plays like a guitar, yeah.
So what is the difference? Like there's more strings?
No, it just buzzes, you know. So it sounds like a sitar a little bit.
Because like that whole thing, like sometimes I try to add those flourishes, those things, and they don't fit into a lot of what I do. They stand out like in the middle of a sort of Peter Green blues run. Yeah. If you throw one of those, it doesn't quite fit.
Do you ever watch Peter Green showing off his guitars?
Yeah. The old Peter Green? Yeah. Oh, like, don't know where I got this one.
It has 14 different, you know, triangles coming out of it, and you're just like...
It's where he's walking around the weird gated the lockup. Where, oh, my God.
Where's the Les Paul again? Yeah.
But tell me, though. I always enjoy hearing the Jamascus play.
All right. Let's see what's going on here.
Yeah, I'll try to set up too.
Sound cool. Good to you?
I don't know.
Yeah. You're hearing it, aren't you?
I'm hearing it. I'm not a fan. I always hear my voice. I'm like, what is that?
All right, I'll be over here riding the levels.
All right.
Go ahead.
All right.
Calling out, I'm deep in doubt to meet you. Calling out ends always with a stare. I can give you less than what I mean to. I'll pretend, but I don't see you there. I wanna go. I'm
Yeah, nice. Nice little blues riff on the tag.
Yeah, I'm practicing my blues for my sound man likes.
Does he? That's his thing? Wait, you want to do one more?
All right.
All I go through, but the thing is, I don't know you, and it's on and on. And the words won't make my eyes close, and if anyone and you know, I can't find out, cause you won't show, and it's on. Every dream shot by daylight, and I pray maybe that you're right. But if you don't, maybe I might, cause it's on and on. Not gonna get me through this, are you?
That was great, Jay. Thanks for coming by.
Sure. Thanks.
So that was me and Jay Maskus. That was fun, right? It's always good to see Jay. He cracks me up. Once you get to know him, he cracks you up. Danny Fields, the man at the juncture of a lot of rock history and a lot of great stories. I was just surprised I got to talk to him because I don't think he gets out much to do these. And he's got there's a documentary out. This is what spurred me to talk to him. It's called Danny Says, a documentary on the life and times of Danny Fields, is now available on iTunes, Amazon DVD, and other on-demand services. But it was good. It was actually a challenging conversation, not in the way that you would think, just in the way of like, man, there's a lot here. How do I get it all in a line? So this is me and Danny Fields. I can't even tell you what exactly he is. He's a A&R guy, a publicist, a provocateur in a way, a conduit. Danny Fields is a connector and a through line to some of the best bands ever. Okay, this is me and Danny.
I didn't send you that book. It's the only thing in my life that I ever did. I never did anything except take pictures, and that's why I'm so proud of it.
I don't know that it's the only thing you did in your life.
It's the only thing I did that I did that was mine, because there's my camera and my pictures,
right,
and
right.
My film,
yeah.
And my writing, my choosing,
right.
Them, and my being able to take them.
Of the Ramones.
Yeah, just during...
What year?
76 and 77.
Those years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The important years, the first trip to Los Angeles, the first trip to London, the first,
yeah.
You know, walking through Washington, D.C., and my voice is shaky because I'm just starting, because I'm always nervous.
You're nervous?
Always.
Really? Like, even if you're just sitting still?
I used to have a show on WFMU 8 hours a week, Thursday and Friday, 8 to midnight.
That was a life changer for you, wasn't it?
I know. And I was so nervous. And if you listened, because they kept it all. And yeah. I have this like, oh, mellow, hey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. The boys. Classic.
Hey, man.
Yeah, the classic FMU.
Yeah.
late 60s. Yeah. FM voice.
Yeah, and I had such freedom, and I just would play half-hour blocks of music and back-sell them. Yeah. I never say, coming up, this, and they just segued, and it was kind of wonderful.
And you started, like I watched a documentary, Danny Says, and I liked it. Now, what was interesting about it is how much different footage they had of you over many different years.
And many different lifetimes, and all squashed together.
Yeah. You know? I've talked to a couple of people that talked about you directly. Well, I had Legs in here recently, but I had Iggy in here, yeah. And you know, and I had Wayne Kramer in here.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the guy that talked to you the most was probably Wayne. But you didn't start out in music. You were like some like whiz kid, right? Where'd you grow up?
In Queens.
Which part of Queens?
Which part of Queens? The southern, not good part of Queens.
There's a good part? There's
oh, yeah. When it gets hilly, it's better.
I lived in Astoria for a while. So it's just like, you were just like a Jewish kid from Queens.
Well, first of all, there weren't many in my part of Queens.
Yeah.
The Jews were rare.
Yeah.
We were not in Forest Hills.
Uh-huh.
And something Goodfellas territory.
Oh, yeah,
does
yeah.
Does that
yeah.
say, yeah. kind of like bring something
mostly
to
mostly Italian.
Yeah. Yes, mostly yeah. Italian, Irish, German.
Yeah.
My father was the doctor. So
oh,
he was
a doctor.
Second only to the priest in authority and
right, right.
sacredness.
He got respect.
And I was the doctor's obnoxious son. loser, sissy son. So, that was rough.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had a younger brother, but you know, Manhattan was there. It was
right.
a subway ride away.
When did you start going in?
As soon as I could get on the train, as soon as I could reach the turnstile.
Yeah.
Always. But, you know, I didn't start. My family was all over. It was a New York family. So there was
right.
the Manhattan
branch.
People and the
right.
Riverside Drive
right.
people. And
aunts and uncles
Brooklyn,
and whatnot.
And then the some ones in New Jersey. And
mm-hmm.
So
spread out.
It was spread out.
Yeah, the Fields diaspora.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
It's all over Brooklynish.
And when did you like you ended up like? Because I did watch the movie, so I know more than I should than when I do generally interview people. But you were a bright kid, right? And
yeah.
you're running.
I'm still
in,
a bright kid.
Yeah.
Because everyone else was so stupid.
But did you go to college when you were like 15?
Yeah, I was 15, and. That was, you know, not the easiest. But
no, I can't imagine.
There's worse things in the
sure.
world, you know.
And what was your interest? What were you going to do?
Nothing.
Nothing.
No interest to have friends.
Yeah.
I wanted
right.
friends. I never had any.
Yeah.
This is so sad.
No, it's not.
I went to Penn.
Yeah.
Which is in some place called Philadelphia.
Right. Sure. Philly.
And it was not heaven on earth. It
yeah.
was not. Compared to New York, it
sure.
did not. Being in the Ivy League, which is meaningless, but the only thing that I meant was that on weekends, you got in a car and pretended you cared about a football game.
Right.
Which I don't even know what the rules are. But you pretended that we're playing
yeah.
a we.
Yeah. The collective we.
I mean, politically,
yeah.
this is, no. It
yeah.
makes me sick to think that I ever used that word. And we were in Princeton or
sure.
we were in Providence,
right.
or New Haven,
yeah.
or Cambridge,
right.
Boston, Cambridge, and I just thought, why am I not here?
Yeah,
this
in
is
Boston.
Where I want to be. I want to be in Cambridge.
You wanted?
I want to be near the streets of Harvard.
Yeah,
just I want to be there.
Because it felt.
I felt like I should be. It's like I feel now. I want to be in London.
Right,
I want to be
yeah,
in New York.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like wherever you are.
There's
you
some
know.
Order to it. There's
yeah.
some a style to it. There's an aristocratic vibe.
No, that's not that. It's a selfish longing to feel as if I'm kind of home.
Right.
you know, I like these people. They like me.
Did you go?
Long last.
Right. Did you end up, you ended up going there, right?
So I applied to Harvard Law School.
Yeah.
So not interested in being a lawyer. It's one of those things like a dentist. I said, well, if I need one of these things, I'll hire one.
Right.
I'll be one.
Yeah.
You know, but it was an easy way to get in and to be living in the Harvard University community because my marks were so good.
Right.
And I got this really high score on the law school aptitude test.
And you went to law school.
There. I went to law school and hated law school, but loved, as I thought I would, as my fantasy told me I would, loved being in Harvard Square.
Yeah.
Which was very not like Queens.
No.
Or Philadelphia.
It is kind of stunning. I lived in Boston for a long time. There's something about Harvard Square.
They want to look cool. Didn't they look cooler? Bigger density of coolness.
Yeah. A lot of layers.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had a lot of options to wear sporty clothing.
I always wanted to know someone who looked like that.
Yeah.
Or all the sporty clothing. Just steal sporty clothing at, you know, J. Press and all the great stores. And try it on.
So what changed with the law school?
So boring, and you had to memorize things. It's not about how smart you are anymore. It's about how good is your memory.
Right.
How well do you know what some judge one day decided should be this final solution term?
Yeah.
Sorry. But should be the ultimate way of reasoning out this problem that is before us. And that becomes the law.
Yeah.
That's the tradition. This is the common law. It all isn't written down.
Yeah.
It's like precedent.
And what year was this?
I hated this.
Yeah.
Oh, going to 59-60.
So what?
Everyone had a suit, and then people...
You liked that, though, right?
No.
You didn't like the suit?
I liked dressed like this.
Oh.
Oh, no.
No.
And I never...
Yeah.
Oh, I hated it. I still don't. I couldn't do it today.
Yeah.
And people went to the bathroom with each other, sat on adjacent toilet bowls so that they could refresh their memories, about the law, this case, which is going to be on the test.
Yeah.
This is the way.
So you go into the bathroom and you hear people in the stalls discussing arguments?
Wait. If you were there alone, you started to feel I'm doing something wrong. I don't belong here. I'm going to flunk out.
If you go to the bathroom alone?
Yeah. I should be with someone. I shouldn't be wasting my time.
Yeah.
So I think I'll just play bridge.
Yeah.
there's a bunch of other people who hate going to these classes, too. And
you found them?
I found them. We found each other.
Yeah.
Believe it. And so we sat there playing bridge. That's arrogant.
What was it that sparked the interest in, I don't know, it wouldn't be counterculture, but it would have been what was happening, like music and everything else?
I think my life and my education probably started there. People who didn't really know what they wanted to do.
Right, but were smart.
Those are my kind of people.
Right.
They're really smart, and they don't know what they want to do, and they're beautiful, and they're young, and they go to Harvard, and they love to fuck, which is important.
Yeah,
very. And you're 19.
Sure.
I was 19 in law school.
Okay. Yeah.
And...
Was it easy to get fucked at Harvard?
Yes. If you were 19, you were easy for anyone in the world to be fucked when they're 19.
But it wasn't, you couldn't be out really, right?
Yes, you could.
No, you could.
What does that mean? There's that word that gets sprung on me. It meant nothing to me. Was I out? What does that mean?
I don't know. It's a word that I guess straight people know.
Yeah, but we couldn't. There were no straight people to know. We found each other.
Yeah, sure.
And in a community of in many ways like-minded people.
Yeah.
Some of whom went to Harvard, some of whom once went and now are in graduate school, some of whom went and finished graduate school but stayed there because it was the coolest place they ever stayed and they couldn't imagine having to leave.
Right.
This bosom of elitism.
So when do you go to New York?
Okay, when I
flunk out of Harvard?
When I dropped out.
Yeah.
I dropped out of Harvard Law School and said I can no longer continue to take up a seat.
Like 1960?
Yeah.
And when did you get locked in with, when did you sort of find yourself in the orbit of whatever was going on art-wise?
Art-wise,
With Warhol and those people.
Yes. Okay, there was a bar.
Yeah.
Called the San Remo with Bleeker and McDougal. So, it was there, and it was a bar that was turning quasi-gay.
Yeah.
It was
but Edward Albee, Andy Warhol, Jasper Johns, Bob Rauschenberg, the
hanging out,
the great art,
yeah,
happened to be gay, but you know, some of the great geniuses of the that era, hung out there. So that's kind of where one would go, and bars that sprung up around that neighborhood.
And you just met them there?
Just went, and then, you know, you'd make a friend and just be like someone who goes, and then three girls had an apartment on that we loved on 8th Street.
Yeah.
And that was a hangout. And you went from being sitting at one table to being able to get up and go and sit at another, which was very important.
Sure. And then you, then all of a sudden,
and then making your own table. Because the ultimate thing, man, things must be different, but to find a prime empty table
and
sit on it by yourself and then watch
who comes.
Watch who comes. Yeah. And it's some a competition that you have with your destiny.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a great table.
Yeah.
I'm going to start with nothing, no money, no drinks for everyone, no buckets of champagne, nothing. Just going to be sitting there.
Yeah.
And it's going to be all right to sit there and let's see what happens.
And you did you collect? Did you make your table?
Yeah. So, I mean, I wouldn't be talking about it now if it had been a complete failure. This is why you came to New York, so you could start a table. That was my start a table. Okay.
But you must have been a raconteur or at least fun.
You know, I wasn't. I wasn't. I never was. I could.
What was your gift then?
I could suffer geniuses.
Oh.
I could love them.
Yeah.
And for
you were a good audience. You were a good battery.
I was a good friend.
Yeah.
To people who are really smart.
When you go to the factory, like, you know, I've only seen this in movies and, you know, I've read about it, but I mean, what was the experience? I mean, it doesn't sound like you had any real affinity for the art necessarily. It was more of a scene, right?
Well, the art, you said that with some amount of patronization. The art. What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant that, like, you know, when
the art was it.
I get it.
You know, it was whatever Andy was.
Yeah,
there was art being generated. I didn't mean to be rude.
Oh, it's okay.
But there was he was having art because he was into mass multiples.
Yeah,
multiples, which is the story of modern art. I mean, this is how Campbell's soup cans art is getting big. I mean, come on, think about that.
Yeah, no one ever seen it before.
Antelopes and then virgins and then Jesus and saints and now soup cans. What? You know, dukes and soup cans.
Yeah, okay. Right.
Historical events and soup cans.
Yeah.
Whoa, this is wonderful. And it turned
the whole intelligentsia and art scene upside down.
It turned everything upside down. Yeah,
but I know at some point you transitioned into working in the music business.
Yeah, okay.
Legitimately.
Legitimately by answering an ad. I always was going to go into print media.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't know what else to say. It was like, what do you want to be? And they said, you've been asking me this forever. Leave me alone.
Yeah.
You eventually have to sort of kind of answer when you start looking at want ads.
Yeah.
And I sold books. I worked at a magazine called Liquor Store Monthly.
Yeah.
As a production. So I learned how magazines get made.
Yeah.
All this enhanced my viability as a print medium person.
Yeah.
Duh. And saw an ad saying, managing editor for Pop Magazine. It's being sought.
Pop Magazine or
just
Pop
Magazine? Pop.
Okay.
Okay. Knowledge of pop world.
So this is post-Warhol. This is like you're already there and in
I'm there
it.
Being nobody.
Yeah.
I'm there being somebody with a floor you could sleep on.
Hanging.
And friends.
Hanging out with Edie Sedgwick.
And friends of friends.
Yeah.
And we were, it's like turning into like a family. But
sure.
You always want, well, he's there because he writes songs.
Yeah.
And he's there because he could do silk screens. And Andy is at the center of this, like, God. And he's there because he's the night watchman.
Yeah.
And he's there because he takes photographs.
And you were just there.
I was there being cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I got the job. There were hundreds of applicants, I was told. The only way I could prove that ever. By lying and pretending he meant the pop art scene. Because there I was going to all these parties at Castelli Gallery.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, knowledge of pop scene, sure. I'm sure, into Rauschenberg opening. Yeah.
I could do that.
And then I got Billboard magazine and memorized it. Like,
yeah.
I could still do, like how I got through college, yeah. memorized yeah. textbooks, you know. And I came in for the next meeting. I could tell them it was 14 on the charts. And
yeah, and listen
know
to
anything
it.
About this.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, you're hired to yeah. be managing editor of a teenage magazine called Datebook.
Uh-huh.
Well, this is nice. He wanted it to be, he wanted it to follow in the successful steps of 16 magazine.
Get those little girls buying the magazine.
I didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
I wanted
yeah.
to write about the Birds and Jefferson yeah. Airplane and the Velvet Underground and the Rolling Stones and what was cool. But I had my in
right
then.
So it was mainstream, and you were not, that was not what
it was.
You
always alternative.
When did you meet the Velvet Underground? How early on was that?
It was, we, a bunch of people from the factory went yeah. to hear them play at the, wherever they were playing.
Yeah.
But before that, Donald Lyons and I had chased this really, really good-looking guy down the street carrying a guitar on McDougal Street.
Yeah.
Of course. And ran out to him and said, hey, you're so good-looking. You should be in an Andy Warhol movie. Doesn't this sound amazing to admit this? We actually did that because why not? This guy has a guitar.
Yeah.
He could be singing.
Yeah.
You know, so that's legit.
Yeah.
Andy likes guys that look good on film. I bet he's going to. And yeah. So why not? Isn't that balls to go up to someone? Say, would you like to be in an Andy Warhol movie? As it was, it turned out great. And there is.
Who was it, Lou?
It was Eric Anderson.
Uh-huh.
Okay. This is in the movie. It was called Space. A bunch of people at the factory, about a dozen, sitting around. Eric Anderson is there with the guitar. Andy is learning how to focus, how to pan,
mm-hmm.
how to tilt,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
on camera.
Right.
And there's this movie.
Yeah.
And Eric is, what can we do to have a hootenanny at yeah. the factory in yeah. 1965? Oh, what a nice idea. We're going to have a hootenanny. You know, we do everything else. Why not have a hootenanny? And Michael rowed the boat ashore, and they tried that, and people fell over and, you know, pushed each other out of the way and preened yeah. and all that.
Yeah.
And Eric and Edie are sort of making eyes at each other. Extremely wonderful. My friend Donald is trying to teach Edie the words to the Hail Mary.
Yeah.
I can imagine, like 30 times. And this is like, yes, this is an Andy Warhol movie.
Right.
This is kind of perfect.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to have been scripted. The scriptwriter in Ronnie Tavelle in disgust walked out, and everybody just kept laughing.
Yeah,
and having a good time. Okay, 5 months after that, the Velvet Underground moved in. So this, to answer your question, I had to take this back route. So that was the music comes through the factory in the
through
form
Eric
of
Anderson.
A solo. Yes,
yeah.
A solo acoustic singer.
Yeah,
okay, who was really talented and beautiful and wonderful.
Yeah,
and then come the Velvet Underground. Might as well have a band. Hey, we had a folk king that worked yeah. out pretty well.
And they hung out for a while.
They hung out for quite a while. And they more than hung out. I mean, it became a professional association with a record and tour. And
yeah.
It was real.
Right.
The factory found itself in the music business.
Right. With the first Velvet Underground album.
Yeah. Yeah. And forever, when you think of it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, then Lou and John go do songs for Drella long after Andy's gone.
How much did he influence them, really? I mean, what was his impact on the Velvet Underground?
You know, yeah. they talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
And a lot. They worship him.
Yeah.
In, certainly in retrospect. At the time, you know, they are a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
They're kind of being used as sort of a toy.
Right.
It's possible to get a movie projector and run a movie and shine it on the band that's playing up there at the same time. We want to do that. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Oh, let's put all these gels into projectors and cover the band with, you know, polka yeah. dots and stripes. Right. Oh, let's do that.
But they just wanted to play.
Yeah, but they also wanted the audience that the celebrity of Andy Warhol and a place.
So here you are immersed in this, and now you've got this job at a pop rock magazine.
Yeah.
And what was your first big...
My first big thing was to do something spectacular and mischievous because I kind of resented... I resented it a great deal.
Yeah.
I did get an invitation to go on the Rolling Stones boat ride, which the boat pulled away before I got there. That's when I met Linda Eastman, too, because we had someone to get off the boat with the camera. That's a whole other story. But
Linda McCartney, the future Linda McCartney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was, you know...
Did she inspire you to take photographs?
Yes, very much. Mm-hmm. Very much.
You wrote a book on her, too, didn't you?
I wrote a tribute memoir, sort of me and her.
Did you stay in touch with her all the way through?
Yes. And as much as you could, because I think when she first married Paul in 1968, 69, I get the feeling he didn't encourage her to keep in touch with her friends in New York, most of whom had columns and or, you know, edited magazines.
Yeah.
Etc. So, but yeah, at the time of his first album, they came back.
Oh, you know, the McCartney album?
Tell us about this music business now.
Uh-huh,
there's no more Beatles.
Right.
Here I am, a soloist, you know.
We can use that guy now.
Yeah, well, we could, yeah. Let's, you know, it'll remind us what's been happening these years.
But you did a Beatles story, though. You did Beatles stories for the date book.
We owned Beatles stories.
Yeah.
Okay. Among the things we owned, which Art Unger had purchased, was a series of interviews with each of them done by Maureen Cleave, who's a London journalist. And I found that we owned them. We owned the right to publish them in America. And so I read them and I said, whoa, this is quite extraordinary. Here, I have to just say what Sir Paul McCartney said. Talking about America, it's a lousy country where anyone black is a dirty nigger. So, whoa, there's a line. Let's put it on the cover of a magazine for 11-year-old girls. Let's see what happens.
And you did that?
Yes. And, oh, yeah. Then there's an interview with John Lennon.
Yeah.
In the course of the interview, he says, oh, we're more popular than Jesus now.
Yeah.
And... elsewhere in the same interview, he said, I don't know which will go first, rock and roll or Christianity.
And he put the other quote on the cover, too?
Yes, both of them. And followed by Timothy Leary says something, and Bob Dylan says something about message songs or something.
So what was Unger saying when you're taking the magazine in this direction?
He was saying, well, this is really a big step. But hey, and as I'm discovering now, many years later, he's considered a pioneer, having been the publisher in promoting a left-wing ethos and directing it at young rock and roll kids and consumers in the middle 60s, which was ahead of its time because, hey, he bought those. Hey, he said, okay. He said, yes, we can use them on the cover and as the headlines inside. So... But, okay.
That's how history is treating him?
I'm glad it's starting to, and in academia, sort of, because he is rather, if I'm obscure, can you imagine how obscure he must be?
Right.
And I was fired for, not that,
just
because I didn't know how to put out a magazine.
Yeah.
You know, I pretended. I was faking. I didn't know how to be an editor. And I've learned, but I wasn't then. After I was fired, the magazine came out as the Beatles were doing a giant stadium tour of the United States. And an irate mother in Alabama saw this, we're more popular than Jesus quote from the Beatles, from John. And they were predisposed in the parts of certain regions of the United States to despise the Beatles existentially.
Yeah.
Okay, this is kind of like the prick that did it. I think they hated them because their daughters liked them, because they had long hair, and so they thought they were faggots.
Yeah.
Because they sang, and they looked, you know, they were sissies or something.
Right.
And girls screamed, and boys hated them.
Yeah.
Because the girls screamed over them, except the boys who were cool enough to like them as a band or whatever. So it turned into big screaming. And then it turned into a book burning
yeah.
where pastors and preachers, no, said to, and DJs, there, imagine if you were sitting there, okay, kid, we just found out that the Beatles are Antichrist,
mm-hmm.
and they think they're bigger than Jesus. Well, first of all, the bigger than Jesus is one of those quotes that never got said, but it's come down in history, so it has kind of familiarity to
right,
it.
Right.
It's wrong. He yeah. said, we're more popular than Jesus. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It, and there were barn fires, bonfires.
Yeah.
B-O-N. And people brought their records, and trucks ran them over, and they poured melted tar on them, and they had blazes. It was like Berlin in 1933.
Yeah.
Burning books. And they were burning images
burning
of
records.
The Beatles. Yeah. It was, this is, how do you get rid of Satan?
Yeah.
You know, why do you burn a witch?
Yeah.
You don't just chop off her head.
Yeah.
You burn her.
Yeah.
Okay, this was it. This
yeah.
is a metaphor for that. And that was happening. Yes, my magazine appeared on the newsstands, and it was causing,
a real reaction.
Real reaction.
And the Beatles were set to tour?
The Beatles were on tour.
Yeah.
And countered death threats, fears, paranoia. What is that sound? Is it a shot?
Yeah.
You know, and then we go on stage, and they could hear nothing. These were stadiums they were playing.
And the girls
giant.
Screaming.
Yeah, the girls screaming. They couldn't hear themselves. They could have been mouthing the words.
Yeah.
I think. I did not know them, but...
and then was that
they
it
They played
for
San Francisco, and it was the end of the two-week tour, and whatever the conversation, there are different accounts of it, they had backstage was, this is going to be our last show. And it was Candlestick Park in September 1966
yeah.
in San Francisco. And they put down, and they never played again, except an impromptu thing in London on a rooftop. But this was it. Now, I didn't, first of all, it wasn't intentional.
It right.
was, oh, yeah, I broke up the Beatles. No, I just printed a story that had run in London, and nobody even paid attention to it. When it did, nobody said, oh, dare, nobody in England.
In London, right. Right.
In all of, wherever, 6 months earlier this had
yeah.
happened. It
yeah.
sank without a trace.
Right.
But in Alabama, it was quite a furor.
It was galvanizing.
It was, yeah, and it started a fire that spread.
Right, and then it was also, it became clear where the rock lines were drawn in a way. Like, I mean, if that's the reaction the Beatles get. I mean, that was the fight for rock and roll at that time.
Yeah. It's so good that we could, isn't that great that we can look at it now and say that? But imagine if you were consumed by it. And imagine if you were them.
Yeah.
Or their fans.
Yeah.
Or the people who said, I knew they would turn out to be Jesus haters, like, because they have long hair.
Yeah.
Like, what? But.
And within 3 years from there, you know, rock would ultimately win that cultural war in a way.
Well, it was a beachfront, let's say.
Yeah.
Beachhead. What's yeah. the word? Beachhead. And,
yeah.
And it was a big battle. It was big. It still, I think, has not been really explored.
No, we've lost some territory in the last
yeah, that,
year.
Yes, and you're going to, and this is part of the story, is that perhaps we're too close to it now, though it was 50 years ago, last
yeah.
fall,
yeah.
well, 50. And we still haven't gotten our arms around what the hell happened.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to them, but what happened to music, and what happened to
America.
Culture as we saw, what happened yeah. to America. It was what we see now.
Yeah.
It was a schism.
Yeah.
And we see it now with this thing
yeah.
that happened after the election thing.
Yeah.
And we saw it then. There it was. It was a blueprint for it. Or as early, it was a sign, a message.
Well, yeah, it was like, oh, that's there. This is part of us. This is part of America.
Well,
you know,
didn't say it then.
No.
He said, well, what have we become? What are we dealing with? What is this death? It's
yeah.
about death. It's about Jesus. It's about fire.
Yeah.
And destruction and...
So when you get fired, is that part of the drive for you to continue in music?
I moved to LA that summer. This all came out while I was living in Los Angeles.
This is before the DJ job?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And I kept thinking, I should move here. This place is cool.
Yeah.
And I stayed in L.A. the summer of 66. I was there to see this wonderful catastrophe happen as the result of a simple decision to put a couple of lights that had already been seen six months before in London on the cover of a magazine to see all hell explode, which was so much fun. And I decided I couldn't live here because this is, I couldn't make it down stoned. I mean, I had to drive down Laurel Canyon Boulevard stoned late at night and with people hating me and the signal behind me because they do it all the time and they could go fast and they may be stoned, but they may not be. And I am. And oh, these curves, here comes another one. Oh my God. And I really, because of that,
you left
before Uber. I don't think I could live here.
Right.
I like to be able to walk.
Walk when you're high.
Cause call a taxi or get in the subway. Okay.
So you go back and then you took the job as a DJ?
WFN, I had friends who, there was a, what was the station in San Francisco that went poof?
Oh, I don't remember.
Freeform, KSFO or KSAN or something.
Uh-huh.
It was Freeform Radio.
Yeah.
And it was, you played what you wanted.
Yeah.
And they decided it was unprofitable and a bunch of people were terminated. And each went out and like a spore, like a, of a species, sort of found a place at another radio station, another market in America. And one of the San Francisco people named Larry Yerden found a small college station in New Jersey called WFMU.
Yeah, my buddy Tom Sharpling used to be on there for years recently. Yeah.
This is,
yeah.
So
still around.
You could do what you want.
Yeah.
It was so great. And they, I got to be a guest. And I did so good as a guest because I have a thing for pretty music.
Yeah.
I hate music, but sometimes it can be pretty.
Yeah.
And I got my own show 8 hours a week, two nights a week. While I worked for Elektra Records, imagine how unethical this is.
You were working for Elektra?
Yes.
At the time?
Like I might as well be, you know, Ivanka Trump. I mean, I was really corrupt.
But what were you doing for Elektra?
I was their publicity head of publicity. The director of publicity.
And that's when you were working at WFMU?
Yeah, at the same time. So on my...
And who were the bands?
Who were the bands?
For the Elektra, who were
you? Oh, this dude is in the MC5 band. But, I signed to them.
But that was after, that was before you were... Wait, you were at FMU when you signed those bands?
68, 69, yes.
So how'd you get the job with Elektra?
Okay, I got it because in the earlier magazine, I had sensed the viability as a popular event, creation of the Doors. And
you sensed it?
Yeah. I saw it happening.
Where, in L.A.?
I saw it in New York from, you know, girls who had gone to see them on their first New York appearance and came back, you know, in a vapors and faint. And
you told Elektra these guys were the guys?
No. Then I had a call from a friend of mine, whom I'd met that summer, Ronnie Heron, and she was a manager of the Whiskey, and she also managed kind of the Doors.
Uh-huh.
And she said, oh, do me a favor, this band I work for is coming to New York, and would you be a publicist for them, sort of? So I said, oh, yeah, sure, that's all, I'll see them. I heard people see them, and And I went to see them. And I called Elektra the next day and said, hey, I'm the publicist for your band, The Doors, it seems. I should say, I'm not getting paid. It's just I'm doing someone a favor, but you have to say that.
Yeah.
And they were thrilled to have a publicist in their midst. And so months later, I was hired by Elektra. There's another magazine I got fired from called Hullabaloo, which became Circus.
Oh, yeah.
I always
get
fired. I got fired from everything.
Well, yeah, but so you had to deal with Jim a lot. Jim Morrison?
Yes, I know. Yes, the word strikes thunder into my being and lightning. Yeah, I did. He was really great the first time I said, "Hi, I'm your press agent." And during they were rehearsing in the morning for their show at Undine's that night. And I said, "I'm your press agent. I would like to interview you one at a time. And I said, come and sit with me." And he told me about who he was and what he did. And okay. And went back to a lecture and I said, "Oh, I'm really glad to be working with these people. And I think they have a hit."
With Light What's My that? Fire?
Yes, but guess what?
What?
It was 7 minutes long, as recorded by Paul Rothchild, and is on the first album. And they said, "Oh, it's 7 minutes long," as I just said. "It can't be a hit. You know, it can't be on the radio unless you're 3 minutes long." And I said, "Oh," and they said, "Besides, we just released Break On Through."
Yeah.
"That Light My Fire, what a song that is." And I was not the first person to say that.
Yeah.
But I was the first person outside the company who came in there and said, "Hello, I think you have a hit there, but it's too long. Do something. Or not."
Yeah.
You know, what do I know?
Yeah.
And they remembered that I was the first person outside the company who came and said, "Hey, you have a hit. And would you like to start a publicity department for us?"
Because it was a hit.
Yeah. The week I started there was number three, headed to number one.
At number 7 minutes, or did they trim it?
Oh, no. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, in the interim.
Yeah.
Of course. They responded to the pressure that was growing.
Yeah.
To, "Hey, that's what a catchy tune you got there. It's a hit." And cut it to 3 minutes, and then it started zooming up the charts.
Yeah. And was that Jim mad about that?
I think who can get mad about having the number one? He got mad when I started intruding as remembering who I had been as editor of a teeny bopper magazine, establishing, creating, promoting, in the style of 16 Magazine and Gloria Stavers, teen idols.
Yeah.
And there he was. Yeah. It was a bull. There was a teen idol. And that picture of him, Joel Brodkey picture, sort of shirtless with a thin string of beads. And we knew this was it.
Yeah.
And that went into the Village Voice, and here's a new teen idol. And we all worked on it from different directions. The record went to number one, supergroup. And what is called a career single, you know, what we in those days.
Right.
That was like more than just a hit.
Right.
It was like a hit that made you.
Yeah.
You know,
mythic.
It was such a good hit. Yeah. Such a good song. And
What was the tension between you two?
Well, okay. I went to see them backstage in San Francisco, and I thought, "Oh, such a snot." Mm. I thought, "Oh, these girls around Jim Morrison, this will never do."
Yeah.
For my new teenage idol.
Yeah.
I must do something about this. So, was in L.A. staying at the Tropicana, rest in peace.
Yeah.
And Nico and Edie Sedgwick were staying at the Castle at 2630 Glendower. Do you know what that is? Across the street from the Frank Lloyd Wright House. That's where Rock and Roll Band stayed.
Yeah.
And Nico said, "Oh, we are so afraid here. Come and stay with us." So I did. And I said, "Oh, Jim, why don't you come up and visit my friends Nico and Edie Sedgwick,
whom
I knew of." You know, there are different versions of this. I saw the movie called The Doors by Oliver Stone. This, I can only remember what I remember.
Yeah.
Okay. So am I looking for witnesses? Do I need them? I don't know.
Yeah.
I said, "Follow my car. I'm going to drive up, you know." And you're so mean. That's when I saw it. It's hard to drive in Los Angeles for a New Yorker to begin with.
Yeah.
It's hard to drive when you have told Jim Morrison to follow my car into the hills.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Trust me.
Yeah.
I think he ducked between cars
to
confound me. This is going on like Sunset towards Vermont.
Yeah.
Drive, make a left. Oh my God. And it was, it was tormenting.
Yeah.
But it was tormenting me for interfering with his girl life, his groupie life.
Yeah.
By insisting. But there I had set him up with Gloria Stavers. There I was working for the record. So I brought him up there. And there were some drugs going around in those days that people had.
Yeah.
And I think he got really stoned. And he met Nico. And they didn't say a word to each other. They stood and stared at the same place on the floor.
Uh-huh.
Can you imagine for a really long time?
Yeah.
Someone goes, Jesus Christ, I'm going to go do something else.
Yeah.
I'm going to play solitaire.
Yeah.
Okay. And they had a tumultuous night of fighting and shrieking and tearing of hair and naked walks around the parapets and hell, he's going to kill me.
Yeah.
And that was, I learned. And he hated me from then on. And also, what I did was, now look, I was working with his record company. They were paying for me to be there. He was so high. He consumed. I don't think I'm the first person in the world who said that.
Right.
He had an astonishing capacity for anything.
Yeah.
And that have the hand and that gesture that says more.
Yeah.
Okay. Looks at the bottle and consumes more. And what if he got killed driving to that fucking Glendower? I'd lose my job.
Right.
So I took the keys out of his ignition and parked in the driveway, his little car that he lived in.
Yeah.
And he put them under the floor mat. I didn't steal his car or anything.
Right.
This made it kind of difficult for him to get away
in
his condition. And there were no phones there.
Yeah.
We're lucky there was electricity and running water. And so in effect, he was kidnapped.
Okay.
Prevented from leaving until things got better. And of course, he never forgave me for that.
Oh, really? That was it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's enough, isn't it?
I guess so. One night,
a star, Jim Morrison? What? I took his...
You set him up with Nico and then hid his car keys?
Yeah, and it's Los Angeles. You hide someone's car keys? Come on, what is
you deserve it.
That's a sin. That's it's bad. That's...
But the Doors, you know, really got you in tight with the record company. You were the guy. For a little while. So what? Now, the way that I understand it, what you did for rock and roll outside of, make teenage girls like Jim Morrison was bring us the MC5 and the Stooges.
Yeah, well, you have to do more than one thing at once. It's like you should have more than one job.
But that to me is like the greatest story, though. Like this idea that you get a 2-for-1 in Detroit or wherever the
hell you went. I know, in one weekend. Isn't that wonderful?
Well, how did you get hip to them? What happened?
The people who, they had played, this is July, this is 68, and they had played at the extremely riotous Democratic Convention in Chicago.
Both of them, or just the MC5?
The MC5, I'm sorry. And
well, they were the White Panther Party, and there was a lot of political thing behind them.
Yeah, at first, I knew of them through Dennis Frohley and Bob Rudnick, who had brought me to WFMU, who had Cocaine Karma, and were politically active.
Yeah.
As of course we all were politically active
to
our own individual degrees.
Yeah.
And so I went out to see the MC5. And but first I started to receive, they put me on their list. I was impressed. Everything was printed and in color, and there was a lot of propaganda and a lot of
promotion.
They had a printing press in the basement. They not only had a mission, they had a printing press.
And that was, what's his name, John Sinclair?
John Sinclair, his influence? Wife, Lenny Sinclair, were conscious of expansive, confrontational, political, they worshipped the Black Panthers.
Action.
They
yeah.
called themselves the White Panthers. Yeah. Okay. And they had their own band. It was like Andy having a band.
Yeah.
And we're a political party, and we need a band. Everyone needs a band.
Right.
And
well, it was the late 60s, too.
It was the late 60s.
Music meant something.
Music meant something, and politics meant something. It was until now, it was the only thing that ever got everybody together was that war.
Yeah.
That hated
Vietnam,
war in Vietnam. And so one participated in anything that attacked the fact that this country was a part of that. And they certainly were, but they were primarily a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
And people who went to hear them went to hear rock and roll and went to see people in satin spinning around and Wayne Kramer being fabulous and Robin Tyner. And
then
the Prelude, Brothers and Sisters. And it's kind of like a prayer meeting.
Sonic Smith.
Fred Smith, Dennis Thompson. It was great.
Raw rock and roll.
It was real Midwestern rock and roll.
from the tradition of Mitch Ryder.
Yeah, and Grand Funk Railroad, yeah, sure. And it was going to become stadium rock in the hands of Grand Funk Railroad, especially, but...
Later, Bob Seger.
It was, oh yeah, he was there. Yeah. Ted Nugent would be sitting on the floor of the, you know...
Of the MC5 ballroom.
Forgive me for saying that, yes. No, on the floor of the garage of the MC5. They would all be hanging out.
Oh, yeah?
We were all hanging out together.
And the Stooges, too?
And the Stooges. Okay, the Stooges came about because they come about. I mean, they existed. Wayne Kramer said to me, say, if you liked this All on One Weekend, September in 1968.
Yeah.
If you liked us, you're really going to love our little brother band. Something he knew about my taste was kind of weird and offbeat. And I don't know how, it's Wayne Kramer. He's how could he not know smarter things than most of us know? And so I said, well, I'd love to see them. I have to go back to New York tomorrow. He said, oh, they're playing across the street at the Student Union of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
And so I went across the street and then heard, because I heard them filling the halls of the
building.
Then I saw Iggy, and then I went, And and the next morning, I said, Iggy walked past me, and I said, do you have a manager? I'm from Elektra Records. He said, he's back there. And I pointed, and he kept walking.
Yeah.
He said he thought I was some dirty old man who was hitting on.
Yeah.
Because no one from a record company could possibly.
What were you doing there?
Yeah. Be interested in them. So I called Jack Holtzman, the president of Elektra, that morning. I said, Jack, I just saw two great bands this weekend. You got to sign them. They were feeling very expansive and expanding. It's more like it in the wake of the Great Doors hits.
Yeah.
You know, they had become a rock and roll company.
Now. They used to be a folk company?
They were folk rock.
Yeah.
And, you know, and with non-sectional, they were classic and inventive. And songs of Bulgaria, you know, they were happening.
Yeah.
You know? And he said, I said, the big one is MC5, and they draw a lot of people. They're really successful. And said, And I said, the little one is kind of starting, and they're a little farther out. Or he said, and you really like them. It's on the phone, and John Sinclair, the manager of the MC5, and Jimmy Silver, the manager of the Stooges, are in the kitchen of the MC5 house in Ann Arbor. And Jack said, see if the big band will take 20,000 to sign. See if the little one will take 5.
Yeah.
I put my hand over the mouthpiece. Remember, there were phones there.
Yeah.
And it's 11 o'clock in the morning on Monday. Will you take 20,000? It was a lot more than it is.
Yeah, now. Sure.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
But they'd never heard. And then 5,000 for the Stooges. And yes, and they were signed. Boom. And then... just wow. And then it got so hard as the 70s moved along, you know, doing the legal and financial aspects of a record deal. I soon got fired. The MC5 got fired. The Stooges got fired. We made a little history there.
But you did the first two records. I mean, they each did their first record.
They each did their first record. The Stooges did their first two records,
which fell on deaf ears for the most part, or no?
Well, it didn't fall on massive ears, but it fell on Lenny Stooges, fell on Lenny Kaye's ears, for example, who wrote an incredible review in, I think, Fusion.
Yeah.
So when someone said, there's that Lenny Kaye, I said, you're the greatest person who ever lived.
And that had power then. You have one good...
But it wasn't just the one. It was a few, but let's just say... Lenny Kaye.
Because I didn't get hip to the Stooges till years later, and it was like, you know, when you listen to them, you realize that if it weren't for them, so many things wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, but they were so, my God, they were so unformed and so pure energy. It was nuclear thing that you can't find. You haven't found something with enough lead to hold it in. It was really... spot.
And
I'm glad you think so.
It just seemed to set the stage for what became the next phase of your, you know, musical interest.
Yes, but not with a big label.
Right.
What happened is what always happens. There are talented people gathering around a nexus of it more than a movement. It's a place where it is permissible to be creative. And there was such a scene in New York in the wake of the Velvet Underground and of course the New York Dolls were hugely, greatly, wonderfully important then in the early 70s. And it was a way of being expressive and wonderful and creative and smart and glamorous and good records and good songs, always good songs.
You know, like you said, that, you know, the Velvet Underground had set the stage for stuff, and, you know, Andy had, and the Stooges had come to New York a couple of times, and Bowie had come. So, like, and there was this crew of bands and musicians centered around the Lower East Side that were all doing, you know, unique and interesting stuff, interesting takes on rock and roll.
It had not much to do. One didn't come because there were there's another, which the implication there would be it sounded like something that was part of something. It did not.
Right. Well, that's the good thing.
Yes. It sounded what these people called the talking heads.
Yeah.
Well, these people called the New York Dolls.
The Heartbreakers.
These people called the Ramones. The Heartbreakers. Yes. You said the Heartbreakers.
Yeah, I said the Heartbreakers.
And Blondie was having commercial success, very unlike what others were doing. But it was, it became a big sloppy old family.
Television.
And at its heart is CBGB's, which is a room that God has blessed with the greatest acoustics that anyone had ever heard. Anything sounds great there. If you're great to begin with, you sound cosmic. Cubed.
Yeah. So when you were there and you saw you were at a table, where were the tables? At Max's and at CB's?
Yeah, tables downstairs at Max's. That was a universe unto itself.
Yeah.
Upstairs, bands played.
Yeah.
It was a different universe. It
right.
was more people who come to hear a band, and downstairs were people who came to hear and see each other.
Well, at that time, who were at the tables, like Lou and Patti Smith?
I was watching the news, and there was this real star-looking newscaster, and I said to Brendan Toler, my director, who I'm in LA with, who's that? Something Shriver. I said, fuck, he's a Kennedy. Wow, it's like a news star. He's a star. He's the son of Sergeant Shriver, and this story has a punchline, and Eunice Kennedy Shriver, who was a sister of Bobby and Shapley. And one night, he came into Max's, I think, with Germaine Greer, and I was with Jackie Curtis, who was a trans, such a new neo-sexual creation of her very own, her very own. And I could say, Sergeant Shriver, this is Jackie Curtis. This is the president's, Kennedy's brother-in-law who started the Peace Corps. And you could do that. That wouldn't be a table at Max.
Right.
Okay.
So it had, it definitely.
I mean, it had Kennedy's.
Sure.
And it had, you know,
drag queens.
It had Germaine Greer.
Yeah.
And drag queens. And
so
and the Warhols, of course, and bands, and then be a long table, and it would be Big Brother and the Holding Company and Janis, you know. Max is downstairs. Upstairs, bands played.
Well, it's interesting because at that time in the early 70s, so all these bands from the 60s were still around, and there was the new thing. So it was that second wave of rock mythology all coming together. And then within creating that third wave, which is the Ramones and that crew.
Yeah, but
I'm inventing waves, but you know what I'm saying.
Yes, I know. But communal in the sense that we came from each other. The members of the band that would become the Ramones would come to New York, to Manhattan from Forest Hills, a simple subway ride, to see the New York Dolls, who were getting all this publicity and drawing all these audiences and getting a record deal.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be so good. And they said, wow, what are we worried about? Why do we have to worry about being good? Because they're just great. They went to great without bothering to be good.
Yeah.
Okay. And we see why they're stars. Look at that guy's hair.
Yeah.
Look what they're wearing. Look at that audience. That's the coolest kids ever. Listen to that song.
So okay, so the dolls were the center of it, and then
the center, and it was the scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
The coolest people would go to one place one night a week, one night a month, and this was all New York. Early middle 70s, the Dolls broke up in 74, and CB's started to be a place where the owner said, oh, sure, you can play
Hilly
here, but yes, Hilly Crystal, only original material, no copy bands. And he was a country western singer at one point.
Yeah.
And a very great and wonderful person with a room with the best acoustics in the world that anyone ever heard. Okay. And of course bands wanted to play there, and then it became a mecca and all that. But back then, with the core bands, it was everyone sounded good. And do you know, but apropos of what you said, there were record company people who would say, oh, that neighborhood, the Bowery, I can't go there, it's not safe. I just told you I could walk there.
Sure.
From where I live.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you could walk anywhere. But if they said that, you're right. Here is a fear, cowardice that's going to keep you back, and it's going to those guys. Look what they're missing. They could have signed all these bands. Seymour Stein wasn't afraid to go.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people weren't afraid, but a lot of people were.
Seymour was
television.
Sire. Sire?
Yes, Sire. And how could
Tom Verlaine,
of course, which was Richard Hill. I mean, okay.
Oh, and Richard Hell, okay. Voidoids,
yeah. Richard Lloyd. I mean, the original television, and Billy Ficker. They were, what a great band.
Oh, my God,
they're great.
Yeah.
You know.
And you were just there all the time.
And so different.
Yeah.
And there, and the people, yes. And you became a voracious fan of great geniuses who were forming their very, very different musical conglomerations.
Yeah, and when was the first time you saw the Ramones?
The first time I saw the Ramones was in 75 at their annoying insistence and behest and leave me alone. Who's on the phone? It's one of them again.
Yeah.
They want you to come and see them. I had no idea. I had a column there, and I wrote a weekly rock and roll column. And
for?
The Soho Weekly News. Uh-huh. It was kind of an alternative. Everything was alternative.
Yeah.
And I was writing about television and Patti Smith. Come and see them, and the Ramones wanted to be included in those columns, and they were greedily after me. I was also the editor of 16 magazine.
Still?
So I mean, I recycled. Oh, now I'm back.
Oh, okay.
I went back and picked up that part of my life on another level and became the co-editor-in-chief of it. We were doing the Bay City Rollers then.
Sure.
So during the day, I was Bay City Rollers, and at night...
You were Patti Smith.
Yeah. And so I went to see the Ramones. Okay. Oh, okay. I'll go see you. Okay. Just tell them to stop calling. I'll go see them.
Yeah.
And they were so great. I mean, 10 seconds into the first thing, and I said... They're perfect.
Yeah.
They look perfect.
Yeah.
The songs are perfect. They're loud and fast, and they're strong.
Yeah.
And first song I heard was "I Don't Want to Go Down to the Basement." And I thought, "That's a song. That's a song. What? What a sentiment. What a lyric. It's beyond comics and that arch." Sensibility. I don't want to go down to the basement, and that's a song. Boom, and the whole set was 14 minutes long, and I thought, "Hooray, this is so good!"
Yeah,
and I met them afterwards. They said, "So, will you write about us in your column?" And I said, "I think I want to manage you guys." But something came over me.
Yeah,
and Johnny looked at me. He was so smart. We need $3,000 for drums. Can you come up with $3,000? Then we'll maybe you can be our manager.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah.
I flew to Florida to see my widowed mother and said, "Ma, I need $3,000. It's just sort of the best band I ever saw." So, thanks to my mother, Ramones got their set. That's a lot of money for a set of drums in 1975.
I don't know.
$3,000. I don't either. It seems like a lot, but. Who cares?
Yeah.
And we were off and running.
Yeah.
It was great.
And how long were you with them?
5 years. It was a contract.
Yeah.
And
you hooked him up with Sire, or who did it first, Stiff?
They were kind of known to Sire, and then my best friend had become Linda Stein, who was married to Seymour Stein, who owned Sire.
Yeah.
And so I brought her to see them.
Yeah.
And she was a real rock and roll person, uh-huh. real rock and roll gal. Seymour yeah. knew it. We all knew it, and she's raving about this. So we did an audition for Seymour Stein, and he signed them on the spot. I want to audition. That's all it took. And first album for $6,400. Okay, and the rest is history. You know, as I'm finding out, as I keep going back to London, now it's the 40th anniversary of that happening.
Yeah.
Going to England, and it meant so much to people. They did something, they changed a great deal. I think even 40 years is not long enough to know what it was they did.
They changed the music.
They changed the music. They changed so much.
Them and the Heartbreakers, too. The Heartbreakers tour to London, I heard, was a powerful shift.
It was, but I wasn't there for that, so you'll have to have Johnny Thunders in.
Sure, we'll get a Ouija board and get him right
down. So wonderful.
But yeah, so when the Ramones went to England, it was like, what the? This is it.
Yeah, and they did something that was commercially very significant. Many bands were forming then. It was kind of a plasma of extremely gifted people in this stew in London. And they had their own concerns, and they had their own politics, and they were very strong, and the people were very strong and powerful and talented. But no one would hire them. And then these four people from New York came for 3 days.
Yeah.
And there was such a word of mouth sensation. I think New York had an exotic, it's an interesting place. It's full of poets and it's very sexy. This is London saying that. But we can't get jobs because.
Were you talking about like The Clash?
Yeah, especially The Clash. Yeah. Yes. And the Ramones played, and thousands of people came to see them on July 4th, 1976, 200 years
from,
ironically,
the
Revolutionary War, that America get us out of this England thing. And here we are back in England and beginning what, in retrospect, turns out to have been a revolutionary period. And one of the things that would make this kind of music, if one would call it that, sort of do-it-yourself music, became commercially viable. People said, oh, they, one of these bands can play at my club, or we can have a little festival in Leeds or something.
Yeah.
And that can be seen as a watershed moment. I mean, also, Grant, it was the Pistols, of course, and their greatness, of course. But let's call it a 1-2 punch. I don't want
to
get into, where did it belong?
Sure. Well, that's you changed it. You helped, you facilitated the big shift.
Yeah, but you didn't know you were doing it then, because I went back this past summer, 2016.
Yeah.
I actually spoke at the British Library.
Uh-huh.
You know, was interviewed by Barney Hoskins, who was so brilliant, who does Rock Back Pages, which you should know about, and everybody. And in front of an audience, and we have the British Libraries, the libraries of the great libraries in the world, wanting to talk about 40 years ago in London. And the more you talked about it, the more I talked about it, the more I asked about it, the more perspective I was adding to it. This is great. Like, most of a lifetime had gone. And it just shows, sometimes you have to get so far from something to look and see what it was and what happened. Because people said to me, oh, what was London like when you got there? I don't know. We got there, we were there for 3 days. And what happened after you left? I don't know. People tell me. I have to ask what happened in the wake of this ignition that the Ramones sparked in London. And so they made history and they changed the world. And after 5 years, they fired me because they weren't selling records. And they kind of knew they weren't going to sell records. But there were millionaires at the time. So they were all gone.
They did all right.
They did quite well.
Yeah, I remember one time I saw Joey and his father eating soup at Veselka, you know, like face to face at a two top table.
Yeah.
And I just saw the profiles. It was so cute.
You knew that was his real biological father?
It looked just like him.
Wow. Yeah.
Maybe it was you.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Didn't he hang out with his father ever?
I think I met him in passing. Oh. His mother was a great friend of everyone. She was very wonderful.
Oh, maybe okay. I'm projecting. Maybe it could have been you. Did you ever have soup with Joey at the Veselka?
Joey, I was kind of shy of Joey. He was so smart and sarcastic and shrewd, and I was kind of afraid of being left alone with Joey. But uh-huh. Johnny and Dee Dee and Tommy, no problem.
Oh, yeah.
But Joey was ethereal
uh-huh.
and so smart. And here's the irony. So they changed the world. Now there's a fiction book called Ramon Ramon, as if they had been brothers, as if they were a large family.
Yeah.
Which I'm giving you a copy of.
Yeah, I'm excited.
It's unbelievably brilliant. This is the conceit. That they really were a family of brothers, and that there was an oldest brother who was a classical composer, and the Ramones stole his great innovative symphonies, yeah. and Abbott made their historic first four albums, which we are also proud of.
Yeah.
And
also, you got to get me the photo book.
And I'll get you the photo book, and you got to read. Damon Ramon is not published. I mean, can I say the word Amazon? It's like nothing. And here's it's a book. It's a book of words. It's not a song. It's not a haircut. It's not leather.
Yeah.
It's just a book that it lies there, and the words come and just strike you. Oh my God, I'm in.
I'm sold.
Exploding.
Yeah, I'm excited about it.
Damon Ramon, that's his name. They were drug smugglers in the book I'm first made on their ship called the Havana Banana. Was smuggling drugs between Rockaway Beach and the coast of South America.
Oh, that sounds funny.
I know. It's very funny and wonderful.
Do you listen to any music?
Beethoven.
Okay. He was good.
I can't say he said it all, but he said more than I will ever be able to comprehend in this lifetime. I would say that, and without sounding pretentious, but yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for talking.
Thank you. This was funny.
Okay, that's it. We did it. We pulled through. We got it. Find your key. I can't play guitar right now because my fingers hurt because I played a bunch yesterday. Like, and I was playing acoustic and the tips of my fingers actually hurt. I know that a lot of you just are disappointed and you're like, hey man, you got to push through. Next time. I have to go, you know, try to exercise so I don't die. All right. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.